Is that okay? Welcome. I think we're okay now. Can you hear me okay? Okay. Thank you. I'd like to begin by apologizing. For a month ago, there was a talk scheduled, and I think some of you may have actually shown up, and you may have noticed I wasn't here. There was a ceremony in honor of our teacher, Lama Zopa Rinpoche. He had just recently had a stroke, and so there I wanted to attend that, so it was a last-minute kind of a rush, and perhaps some of you received an email, and you were informed beforehand, and you didn't come. Some of you, I know, actually showed up at the door, so I apologize for that. Can you give me, so this is a kind of making this talk on working with here we're working with negative emotions, into parts, spreading over a number of talks. And I'm just curious, or it would be helpful for me to know, of how many people weren't here 2 months ago. We're not here. Okay, get their names, and why weren't you here? You have no excuse. I joke. Okay, that gives me an idea of maybe we can do some review of groundwork. I think it's quite useful. Buddhism, I think, and by all means, these are my own speculations, you know, and I wouldn't want you to think that I'm in any way an authority, and that somehow I'm speaking some kind of truth. These are just kind of some assumptions that I've made over time, and I'm kind of sharing this little bit of knowledge that I've been fortunate enough to have received from my teachers. But, you know, the Buddha said that we are to question, you know, like the simile which is used is as a goldsmith assays their gold, you know, by cutting, rubbing, and testing in that way, and deciding for oneself within one's own experience what is being said is true or not, whether it is validated within your own experience and through your own reasoning, whether it's internally consistent and so forth, whether it's logical. So, by all, is that better or worse? Okay. And in conclusion, I'd just like to add a few words. Okay. So I think I'm still wrestling with Buddhism. I think I appreciate that fact about myself that I haven't. It hasn't crystallized. I'm still questioning, still wondering, and still learning. People who pursue a path, especially that of Buddhism, will remain students very much their entire lives. There's always this questioning and searching. Sometimes we arrive at a degree of certainty, and sometimes that certainty is kind of pulled out from under us, and we lapse back into a sense of openness and groundlessness, and we have to search again. But the searching, I think, is somehow not quite the same as it was before. I think Buddhism is very much a process of education, an education in values and how to use our intelligence. So in that way, perhaps it is different than the type of education that we are used to, especially in the West, where we simply are to repeat very much what has been instilled in us in one way in one way or another. Is that better? We're getting better all the time. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So values are simply what is important to ourselves. You know, what we're willing to invest our time, energy, our resources, our life into. And so I think Buddhism might have something to say about what is actually important in making a successful life, which is all of what we want for ourselves. We all want a good life, and how to go about bringing that about. But also it's a process of how to best use our intelligence, perhaps as a way of bringing that about, in fact. And by intelligence, and here I'm going to emphasize some of these points again and again, even though I think, if you want to learn, the best way to learn is to teach. So obviously I have a lot to learn. And many of the things I need to learn are quite sound very basic or simple. But for me, they're quite complex, and I'm still wrestling with them. So I'm going to share my struggle with you in some ways. That's why I preface my few words that I've said thus far with the idea that I'm still working through many of the notions that I'm going to present, and I hope you'll wrestle with me, and we can share in that process. That's what a sangha, a spiritual community, is all about. It's a place where we practice truth as best we can, as best we know it, as best we can get in touch with it. Did you bring a note? That's okay. When I use the word intelligence, I mean not just the mind's ability to think clearly. I think that would be too narrow of a way of looking at intelligence, but that's quite often the way we do think about intelligence. I also have a sense that it is intimately related to the mind's capacity to feel and experience emotions. So, we can talk about a cognitive intelligence, I think, and an emotional intelligence. You know, how we view the world, how we think about things, and how we feel about the world, how we relate to the world. You know, we as... there are two fundamental aspects to who we are, to the dimensions of our being. There's, on the one hand, there's a private aspect, that part of ourselves which is inaccessible to others, which is our own lived inner experience. You know, the eye of the inner domain of our life. But there's another aspect of ourself that is the public aspect of who we are, that part of ourselves which is lived through our outer relationship with the world, you know, the eye of the outer domain of life. If we're going to... I think this is important because we want to live the best and the fullest, most meaningful way of life that we can imagine about ourselves. And perhaps we have to begin to re-envision or re-image or imagine what that might look like. Because I think if we're going to live, actualize the fullest human, our fullest human potential, we're going to have to make effort not only at finding some sort of inner peace for ourselves, which I think we can do by cognitive intelligence, but also how we're going to live in this world in a meaningful and skillful way. We're social beings. Mental health is very much a social phenomena in which we necessarily have to begin to exercise or utilize our emotional intelligence as well. So we can't have one at the expense of the other. The path is likened, especially in the Mahayana, like two wings of a bird. We need wisdom, that's for sure, how we view the world, how we see things. But again, we also need the qualities of healthy emotions, most basically, for example, compassion, love, in order to live a full and most meaningful life, to realize our fullest possible potential of what we can be. So I think this is what Buddhism is trying to assist us in doing. Help us to reprioritize what is important, to take a cold, hard look at where we're investing our time and energy, our resources, our life. And is this what you really want for yourself? Where is this going to take you? You know, unless you change your direction, you're likely to end up where you're headed. And it's where you're headed, where you want to go. So it asks us from many points of view to question and to reprioritize, to find out what is really basically important for you as a very unique, self-actualizing human being that we all are. It also asks us to develop ourselves, to understand how we exist in relationship with others. You know, we can't avoid it. That's why I have, in the last number of years, been very, the notion and the area of concern has very much been focused in emotions. And I can sort of personalize this to some degree. You know, I don't want to make this a true confession, you know, a soap opera. But I know for myself, you know, one, I was a monk within the Tibetan Buddhist tradition for about 17 years. And I think, you know, for any major decision in our life, there's a complex of emotion, of motivations. You know, we can't, it's very difficult to say, well, this is the reason I did this, or this is the reason I did this. It's a very complex mix of various motivations which change over time. But having said that, I know in retrospect, in hindsight, that one of my main motivations for becoming a monk is the pain that my relationships were causing me. And this is when I was fairly young, I guess, at least from my point of view now. I think I was about 27, okay. Still wet behind the ears. And I thought, well, if I became a monk, I can avoid that entire area. I can build this iron fence around myself, and I won't have to deal with the pain of relationships with others. I think I learned a lot as a monk, and one of the important lessons that I learned is that I could never avoid that area. To lead a happy and healthy, sane life, we have to look at all the various areas of how we are being in this world. What is impinging upon us, our various views, but also in terms of those areas that we would like to avoid, those painful, difficult areas. I think this is a great lesson in and of itself. And we all have a tendency, and this is going to come out, I think, in this course of these talks, of seeking to what we might call experiential avoidance. We're numbing ourselves, insensitizing ourselves in various ways, distracting ourselves, denying, rejecting a great part of our experience. And with that, there's no more learning. There's just this repeating of what has been in the past, and our life begins to narrow down, and we have to keep constricting the areas of our concern. And something, the life goes out of our life, the vitality, the fullness, the richness, because we aren't willing to experience all of life in all of our various emotions and feelings. So this is, in some way, I'm underpinning a lot of what I'm going to say, some of the ideas. And this is my personal story, but hopefully I can say it in such a way that it'll be meaningful for you in terms of the ideals of how Buddhism would go about looking at our emotions and how we can work with difficult emotions, what we might call negative emotions, but also maybe in the future talking about shifting the emphasis to positive emotions. It's all not doom and gloom, okay? So I think through training we can move from an unintelligent to a more intelligent approach in terms of our emotional life. So this training, you know, is not simply a matter of utilizing our willpower without using our intelligence. You know, willpower has a sense of organizing capacity of the mind. And sometimes we think that we can achieve almost anything by means of willpower. If you just try hard enough, you can do it. If you're just sincere enough. But I don't think, you know, I think we need, I think it's that's too simplistic of a notion. You know, we try to reduce everything to a cause A will bring about result B. But there's a complex of causes and a subtlety of associations and assistances. And we have to recognize that there are forces which are working in opposition to what it is that we're trying to achieve. I think we have to go about this rather intelligently if we want to achieve our ends. And this applies to almost anything in life which is complicated or complex in some way. So real change doesn't originate from simply an intellectual decision, I'm going to do this and not this. I'm going to, you know, from today onward when I walk out this door, I'm going to be a compassionate person, I'm never going to get angry. That would be nice, but I think that would be a bit foolish to think in that way. But nonetheless, we try, we struggle in that way, and we keep failing in one way or another. And we get down on ourselves because we're trying to do almost what is impossible. We're not using our intelligence, we're not bringing our intelligence to bear on how we're going to bring about this change. Effective change comes from utilizing our basic intelligence. Learning how to see how our minds are actually operating, how they're working, what is true, what is beneficial, what is deceptive, what is harmful. So an intelligence that informs our perspective, you know, about our predicament, what is the nature of our situation, and which begins to show us a way forward. You know, I think our minds are our greatest teachers if we pay attention well enough in an open-hearted and healthy and accepting way. So we're looking at emotions. We can look at last 2 months ago, I looked at the criteria for what we mean by positive and negative emotions. You know, the title of this series of talks was Working with Negative Emotions. Well, how do we determine what is a negative emotion? Maybe your negative emotion is not my negative emotion. Maybe my positive emotion is not yours. What's the basis for determining? By what criteria are we going to make use of if we're going to look at, you know, employ our intelligence, our emotional intelligence, in helping us to cultivate and train in what we determine as positive emotions? But over and above this, the reason I'm going into this is not only is it important that we begin to make some distinction about what is positive emotion and negative emotion, but we also have to take a look and be aware of how we are relating to our emotions at all. What is our unconscious view regarding a particular emotion or emotions in general? We have some view around that, whether it's conscious, whether we can articulate it or not. We have some ideas about emotions and how we're going to relate with emotions, and they're affecting how we lead our life, whether we can bring that to conscious awareness or not. For example, anger may in fact be a problematic emotion. For many of us, it probably is. But our relationship to anger might be equally problematic. How we view anger, how we relate with anger, how we deal with anger. And that could be even cause us even greater problems, or at least we have to begin to aware that there could be a problem there and begin to look at that as well. So how we determine, how we go about classifying what is positive and negative makes a difference. We talked last time about in terms of making a distinction between positive and negative emotions, the general Western or the popular view of emotions. I think, and you know, this is up for grabs, we could discuss this, and we're going to have some discussions around this. If it feels good, it's positive. If it feels bad, it's negative. Okay. Sadness is a negative emotion. You feel flat, you feel down. Attachment, especially to a beautiful body, an attractive body, it feels good. it's exciting. That's a positive emotion. So I think, so we are receptive, we are open to these positive emotions, we invite attachment into our life, desire into our life. You know, probably the whole capitalist enterprise is based upon that assumption. All of our advertising is based upon that notion, probably, how to cultivate desire. And on the other, we avoid, or we restrict, or we deny, or we desensitize ourselves to feelings which are negative, which are don't feel good for ourselves. We reject those in some way or another. That's one possible criteria. If it feels good, it's positive. If it feels bad, it's negative. And the other was in terms of a lot of some types of psychotherapy. And you know, there's no universality about this at all. You got three psychotherapists in a room together, you'd have three different opinions. Maybe four. But anyway, a lot of them would say that emotions are neutral. They're neither good nor bad. You know, maybe what you make of them could be classified as being positive or negative. But in and of themselves, they're kind of just energy, just neutral in that way. And that has a consequence on how you know the therapist is going to, and how their client is going to work with these emotions. It's going to have some impact. And how are we viewing our emotions? One particular therapist who was here last year at the Mind and Its Potential Conference was Barbara Fredrickson, and she has this notion, or she's an advocate of a particular area of therapy called positivity. And she has a division of positive emotions and negative emotions, and positive emotions are feel good, and you want them. You kind of organize your day such that you're going to have more of them. You know, you work with that. So, you know, what she means by positive emotions are emotions such as gratitude, as inspiration, as hope, as interest, love, joy. These are the kinds of emotions that she would regard as positive emotions. She also, you know, sets out negative emotions. And she makes an interesting distinction. Some appropriate negative emotions and gratuitous negative emotions. So, for her, appropriate negative emotions are, for example, mourning. Mourning, if there's a loss, if someone dies, you go through a period of sadness. It's a negative, it doesn't feel good, but it's appropriate. You know, it leads somewhere. As opposed to gratuitous negative emotions, which simply don't go anywhere and they don't feel good. They're just painful in and of themselves, and they don't benefit in any way. So we're beginning to sort of, well, question, well, what kind of criteria are we going to use in determining what is a negative emotion, what is a positive emotion? And it's offering some possibilities. What about Buddhism? How does it distinguish positive and negative emotions? This is easy for me because I'm going to read a paragraph by the Dalai Lama, okay? I can kind of sneak out of this. Buddhists distinguish between two kinds of emotion. One type is without reason and is just based on prejudice. Hatred is one of these. This sort of emotion will rely on superficial reasons, of course, such as, this person has hurt me terribly. But deep down, if you pursue the reasoning further, you find it does not go very far. Emotions without proper reason are what we call negative emotions. The other kind of emotion, which include compassion and altruism, is emotion with reasoning, because through deep investigation you can prove it is good, necessary, and useful. Notice it's interesting because in the Dalai Lama's criteria, there's no mention of whether it feels good or not. And he's not using that. That isn't a part of the criteria for determining whether this is a negative emotion or a positive emotion. I think what we can say is, from the point of Buddhism, the distinction between positive emotions and negative emotions comes down to whether the emotion serves to perpetuate our experience of suffering, or whether it serves, that is to say, the reoccurrence of our problems, or whether tends toward freeing ourselves from those problems, that suffering. So this is a pragmatic basis. The Buddha in delineating his path. That is to say, from where we are at now to the freedom and wholeness and health that we're trying to work toward, he used as his pragmatic basis the question, the criteria of pleasure and pain, suffering and happiness. There's lots of ways that you could delineate a path, other criteria that could have been used, whether it's pleasing to God, whether it's pleasing to the state, or whatever. You could use different parameters. The Buddha used, on the practical assumption that everybody wants to be happy, no one wants to suffer. You know, we could argue till the cows come home whether there is a God, whether it's the nature of the universe and so forth. But it's difficult to honestly argue as to whether we want to be happy or whether we not want not to suffer. You know, your suffering might not be my suffering. Your happiness might not be my happiness. It's unique to each of us how we define happiness and suffering. But nonetheless, by definition, that which we're seeking or moving toward is happiness. That which we're trying to move away is suffering in some way. This is basic to sentient life. This is almost what we mean by sentient life, approach and avoidance. That which we see as enhancing our welfare, our existence in some way or another, we move toward. That's a natural tendency of the mind. That which we see as threatening, as diminishing our prospects in terms of our well-being, we're going to move away in one way or another. Approach and avoidance. So this is the criteria of how we're going. So the sadness, for example, which in general population might be a negative emotion, which might be a gratuitous emotion for Barbara Fredrickson, it might be a neutral emotion for many therapists. Sadness could be a positive emotion. It's not a matter of whether it feels good or not. Sadness could lead us to bring as a catalyst for change, positive change. Regret is a changeable mental factor. It can lead us to regret the wrongs that we've done in the past, and therefore bring about self-correction. We can lead us on toward our path, or it can act as a disincentive. We can regret in the wrong ways, and it simply causes us to feel bad about ourselves. So it's whether it serves to liberate us from the reoccurrence of our problems, whether it reinforces our difficulties and our suffering, or whether it tends toward our well-being and happiness. And this is the way we're going to delineate the criteria which we're going to make use of in determining, saying, this is a healthy motivation, or emotion, or a positive emotion, or an afflictive emotion, or a negative emotion, or whatever term we want to make use of. There's another, I'm going to come up with a simple definition, but I want to bring out one other fact which I brought out last time. There is, in terms of positive and negative emotions, all negative emotions are wrong consciousnesses. That is to say, the way the object is appearing to that consciousness at that moment is not the way the object actually exists. Anger is a wrong consciousness. The way that object of anger is appearing to that consciousness at that moment is not the way the object actually exists. There is necessarily and always a depreciation of its positive nature and exaggeration of its negative qualities. And the opposite is true for attachment. There is an exaggeration of its positive qualities, and an overlooking or a diminishing depreciation of its negative quality. So the mind is imbalanced with regard to its object. That's why all the negative emotions are wrong objects, are wrong consciousnesses. Therefore, anything which leads from that is not going to be in keeping with the actual nature of the object. The way we're going to deal with that situation or that person or this event or whatever it might be can never be quite accurate in terms of, because there's some degree of discrepancy between how the object is appearing to ourselves at that moment of anger or attachment and so forth, and how it actually exists. There's always an inaccuracy in terms of how we're going to relate with that object. And therefore, in some way or another, miss the mark in working and using that as a basis for how we're going to relate with that object. Therefore, there's always a sense of inappropriateness to a lesser or greater degree. I mean, this can be a real learning process in itself. For example, when we have attachment or desire, and when we exaggerate the nature of the object, what factors are we exaggerating with regard to the positive qualities about the object? Are you hot? Are you hot? Yes, okay. You better now? So what do? Okay, thank you. So, I'm going to talk about emotions in terms of positive emotions are those which are beneficial and appropriate. Okay, that's all I'm going to say. I think that's kind of simplifying it down to a criteria. They're beneficial, they help us, they tend toward the liberating from or freeing from our problems, our difficulties, our suffering. And they are appropriate in that they are in keeping with the actual nature of the object of that particular, for example, compassion. Is a positive emotion, in the sense that most essentially, compassion is simply a wish that this object not suffer. From the side of the object, from the person, that person, you can be assured that this person doesn't want to suffer. My wish that they not suffer is in keeping with the actual nature of the object. Okay? Therefore, it's appropriate. To compassion is an appropriate response. So I'm using as my criteria. I've just simplified all of what I'm trying to say in terms of positive and negative emotions. Positive emotions are beneficial and appropriate. And when I say so, by beneficial, it frees us from the reoccurrence of our problems, our suffering, leads toward real happiness. That's the benefit. The appropriate aspect of that part of that is that it's in keeping with the nature of the object. And the example that I used is, for example, compassion. It is in keeping with the nature of the person. For example, with that person, compassion is the wish that the person not suffer. The person from their side, they wish not to suffer. So my wish that they not suffer is in keeping with the nature of my object, that they not their wish that they don't suffer themselves. So there's a correspondence, there's no gap, there's no discrepancy between what I want for them and what they want for themselves in terms of this emotional quality of freeing from suffering. Okay? So it's in keeping, it's appropriate. Whereas, we're going to talk more about this, when we, especially, it becomes very evident around desire and attachment. Why is it, you know, there's a saying, there are two great tragedies in life, not getting what you want and getting what you want. Even when we get what we want, it turns out, we have to begin to search all over again. The thirsting, the craving never quite goes away. Why is that? It should have been, that's the way it appeared. If only I could have that, then I would be eternally content. We're overestimating the nature of that object. And that's the way we're relating for it. And even when we appropriate it, we get what we want, it turns out to be not what we really wanted at all. To a large extent, we have to move on to something other, to something more. So this is the way I'm talking about it. beneficial, positive emotions are beneficial and appropriate, whereas negative emotions are not. Okay, now we're going to begin to look at the, we've covered some of this material already, so we're going to look at some, we're looking at negative emotions, and I'll cover mainly the negative emotions of anger and attachment, pride and jealousy. You know, there are others, but there's especially amongst them ignorance. But that would take, that takes, maybe in the future we can talk about that, but I don't know. I'm very ignorant of ignorance, actually. So we'll begin with anger. And I'm not used to using a whiteboard. This is kind of a new thing for me. I'm moving out into new territory here. I put a definition of anger on the board because I want to show you how this, you know, how I want to deconstruct that definition in some way. To see, it's really important that we see how this is actually working for us within our experience. That's what's important. So, the definition of anger, a mental factor that, I can't read the board. Can you read the board? A mental factor that perceives its object as unattractive, exaggerates its unattractiveness, becomes antagonistic, and wishes to harm the object. Okay, so it's a mental factor that perceives its object as unattractive. So there's some kind of contact. Contact is a mental factor that coming together of an object. A sense medium, like the eye sense organ, and the preceding moment of consciousness, those three coming together, contact arises. Contact is always associated with some kind of evaluation with regard to the object. Is that object, you know, it can be, we can use lots of different synonyms. Is it attractive? Is it unattractive? Is it agreeable? Disagreeable? Is it safe? Is it threatening? So we're evaluating the nature of the object. So it's the initial position which the mind is taking with regard to that object, and how do I view that object, and then it exaggerates its object. So this is there's a lot going on here. Here we're talking about that, you know, from this contact. Or we meet with, we evaluate the object as unattractive. Then there's a subjective reaction of a negative, displeasure. We don't feel good about, there's a feeling quality, the initial subjective reaction to that unattractive object. Then there's a proliferation around that. We begin to, you know, this is unsafe, this is not good, there's something going wrong here. And then all the various mental states, various belief systems begin to develop. Our ideas and feelings and associations, you know, our conditioning around that, the nature of what's happening. And we will, in terms of when we begin to exaggerate the negative qualities, the unattractiveness, it's going to lead us down a particular path. The mind is going to cascade toward eventually anger, hostility, resentment, aversion, some way, you know, using these as almost synonyms. So the object of our anger. I'm trying to play this out to give us a feeling for what's going on here. So the object of our anger can be animate. It can be a person, an animal, or so forth. It can be an inanimate object. It can be a pile of dirty dishes when you get home. It can be it can be an unwanted thought in your mind. You get angry. It could be almost anything. So, I'm just using the word anger, okay? We can nuance, and we will to some extent, but within Buddhist literature, you know, there's different aspects of anger and different terms which are used. I'm just using it as a rough approximation. Anger, annoyance, or irritation, or hostility, or resentment, or hatred, and anger, just more or less the same, more or less, you know, for simplicity's sake. There's an impulse to get rid of the object, whatever it might be, to remove it. We find that, you know, we find the object disagreeable, and we want to exclude it from our domain of what we identify with as either I or mind, our sense of our territories being violated or something in that nature. There's a sense of threat to our well-being. Our value is being diminished. We are being treated unfairly. You know, there's an ensuing struggle to remove it permanently, exclude it from our domain as either I or mine. What the I and mine could be quite ambiguous in a way. What is mine? It could be my planet. Get off my planet, you know, or just get off my block, or get out of my room, or get out of my sight, you know, whatever the mind is. So we want to exclude the object, to remove it. There's a sense of threat, a diminishment of our well-being in some way. So most essentially, you know, I've just gone through a lot of feeling tones around what the quality of anger. But most essentially, what's important is to simplify it down to the basic notion. When we say anger, and more or less these other synonyms, irritation, hostility, and resentment, and so forth, we mean an intention to harm. Okay? So, this is more or less what we mean, an intention to harm. And I've written up on the board, and I talked about this 2 months ago, but I think it's important. And the reason I think it's important to go into this, to nuance, and to clarify what Buddhism means when they say it's best if you can abandon, diminish anger. You know, why is Buddhism asking us to diminish and abandon our anger? In order to prevent ourselves, in order to prevent our harming others, in order to lessen the mental discomfort that we immediately experience while we're angry, and also to avoid the future negative consequences of anger. It's not in our benefit, and it's not appropriate, in other words. So, but we have to, you know, many well-intended Buddhists, they make life rather hard for themselves, and I'm included in that as well. You know, we try our best. We want to be good Buddhists, you know, for one reason or another. And we hear our teachers say, you know, abandon any intent to harm. Abandon ill will, one of the 10 non-virtuous actions, for example. What do they mean by that? And we have a tendency to overextend what is actually being gotten at here into areas where it doesn't really apply. And we, in the end, we become frustrated, we become disillusioned, we do harm to ourselves in some way or another. So therefore I think it's really important to kind of nuance what is really being intended here. So these are some possibilities, and we could make a list of these, and you know, this would be really these would be great things just to workshop these ideas, so we really touch where that's not what Buddhism is talking about, or that is where Buddhism is talking about. So, outright intention to harm, okay? Give me an example. This is not a spectator sport. Pardon? Okay, so what would you do? Say, you stupid idiot. Yes. You know, maybe you wouldn't, but... okay. Outright intention to harm. Is that intent to harm? Yes. That's anger. Yeah, I think so. What about strong reactive dislike? Give me what would be the example?
Road rage.
Road strong reactive dislike. Okay. So the okay. So is there intent to harm? What happens if you see somebody hitting a child, and you feel, and you walk up to them and say, "Please don't hit your child." You have a a strong reactive dislike for them to hit the child. Is that anger? It could. Okay, there could be instances where you could have a strong reactive dislike, but no intention to harm. Could you imagine that? Yes, please.
I don't know if I call it strong reactive dislike, but the
now. Yeah, I know what you mean. Okay, but that. Is there an intent to harm?
Yeah,
not really. Okay. Assertiveness. This is a big one for Westerners, I think. Yeah. Can you be assertive without the intent to harm? Yeah. Example? If you push too far with someone. You want to force your idea on them? Asserting, okay. What if somebody gets in front? You're queued up, and somebody gets in front of you and say, "Would you mind going to the back?" I don't intend to harm them, but sometimes there's different words in English language, aren't there, for aggression and assertiveness? You know? Sometimes we make that distinction. Sometimes we don't. So I'm just pointing it out that we can nuance these in such a way that these can be healthy, useful emotional responses, but have nothing. They don't necessarily have to be associated with anger. They don't necessarily have to be associated with an intent to harm. They could be. That's the point. They could be. Could be mixed. So only we would know. But I don't. My point in bringing this out is sometimes we spread the net too far, and we don't really examine, and we think that we can't be assertive to be a good Buddhist, or we can't have dislikes to be a good Buddhist, or we can't proclaim difference or create independence. You know, we can't set boundaries. No, please don't come in my room without knocking. As a good Buddhist, I can't do that. It could be. Yeah, setting boundaries could be very helpful for everybody, for yourself and everybody else around you. But it could be, you know, if you said, if you walk in my room without knocking again, I'm going to smash you in the face. Then that's another question. So I'm just sharing my own experience, what I've had to go through. Please.
First bus come late, second bus we just missed, and then I am frustrated or angry. But what's the object, you know, really? How the buses run in Sydney. There's no specific object, it's not the driver. Often such a driver drive, and I say, oh, so hard in the city, it is full of cars. Couldn't go through. So there is no one to be angry at, or the state of affairs. Object, but it's
what can you do
about it? So it's an anger that just can't get anybody to
blame. Well, that's that. You're being quite reasonable about the whole thing. I don't think there's negative as.
But that's the worst.
What
the anger is out of the powerlessness. It's too far to go.
Should be on time. So what is the object of our anger? The bus is late. There's something wrong here. Things should not be this way. Samsara. I'm angry at Samsara. Get out of the way, Samsara. And we're going to talk more about that. We're going to talk about the conditions and the causes for the arising of anger. But for sure, every consciousness has an object. Consciousness are subjects. Anger is the subject. What is the object of that anger? It'd be interesting to kind of investigate that. Punctuality. Are you angry at punctuality? So there's an object which is unattractive, and you become you exaggerate the unattractiveness of the object. Shantideva has Shantideva, I think, in the sixth chapter of his Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, says something to the: if there's something that you can do, then why be upset? If there's nothing you can do, then why be upset? But have you ever noticed when we become embroiled in these emotions, our reason goes out the window, doesn't it? We're not thinking very clearly. So I just wanted to emphasize. I'm just as a sense of just my personal sharing with my friends. So you don't have to go through a lot of hardship for no reason at all, putting difficulties on yourself, which neither Buddhism nor a healthy approach to life would want you to do. It's also, we could point out to the fact that, and I think this is maybe another useful piece of information, that the opposite of hatred, or for example, I'm using these words more or less synonymously, anger and so forth. Hatred is non-hatred, and which involves a positive regard for the object, an engagement with the object. So the opposite of hatred is not disengagement or shutting down. Sometimes people can we can use the Dharma to reinforce a lot of our neurosis, a lot of our misconceptions, as a way of just reinforcing a lot of unhealthy patterns in our life. Some people who lack a sense of self-assertiveness or inability to set boundaries, against what they see as wrong, or the lack of ability to take a stand or to respond to situations in life, they can say, well, I'm practicing non-hatred. They can justify what is in fact perhaps not all that healthy of a way of relating, and they can rationalize it by misusing the notion of the Dharma. By not setting boundaries, I'm practicing non-hatred or non-anger, and ways like that, kind of twisting it around. There is nothing positive or Dharma in making oneself a doormat. Making yourself a victim is not the practice of non-hatred.
not sure if that was how you interpret victory. So I often get a bit confused or uncertain or struggle with the way how to interpret that. I mean, lots of people, even amongst Buddhists, have a different way of interpreting
that's
it,
right.
assertiveness. But on the other hand, assertiveness is the one example, right?
You could assert yourself by giving the victory away.
No. What I'm saying, in situation, then if someone is clearly wrongdoing, then you should be assertive.
Okay.
By saying that I don't think what you do is wrong or is right. So by doing that, it's not against Buddhist principle. But on the other hand, we also been taught to hand over the victory.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we interpret that?
So the eight verses, the training of the mind, one is training one's own mind. We don't have control over what other people do to a large extent. You know, we don't have control.
Yeah.
We don't have much control over what the external world. So in mind training practices, the emphasis is on reframing the situation in such a way that the external facts can remain the same, but the way you view it is different. That's the emphasis on mind training. Not to change the external world, but to change the mind itself, which is viewing it. Well, not okay. You want
to?
Okay. Okay. Okay, so not making oneself a doormat is that one has every right to stand up and assert oneself. One has a right to be happy, just as everyone else does. And you know, we can if someone else is infringing on your right, then you can draw a boundary there and say no, I think that's perfectly acceptable. There's no problem without the intent to harm at all. When we give away the victory, this is a practice of mind training. And as you said, there are many ways to interpret it. One of them is that we're stepping out of the whole economy of victory and loss. You know, that this is not our criteria any longer about how we're going to lead our life. You know, and I think it's on that basis. I mean, that's one way to look at it. It's not as if we're sacrificing or denying. It's that we're, you know, if you feel like you're denying yourself something, then you're still within the economy of victory and loss. For one reason or another, you're waiting the interaction on toward giving away. Why you're doing that is up to debate. But if you're willing to step out of what are called the eight worldly concerns altogether, these are not, you know, pleasure and pain is not my priority. I have other gain and loss, victory and, you know. That you have, you're beginning to. These are not longer your priority in how. What will determine how you're going to react and relate with the world any longer. So it's not a. So giving away the victory, you're also giving away the loss. That whole notion, that whole way of looking at the world, the whole way of relating to the world, in terms of that constant struggle, you're foregoing that. I don't know if it's an excellent question, and I think this is really a problematic area, and I think it causes a lot of problems for people. Yeah, it's a good struggle. It's worthwhile.
That is similar to renunciation, where you don't renounce, you know, your car or your house, but you renounce the attachment to it.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. 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 Excellent. Yeah, that's right. Renouncing your attachment, renouncing the causes of suffering. Yeah.
In that way, you're abolishing loss somehow, if it can psychologically be done. I mean, it can be said, but done means that I want to achieve something. You have to give up all the achievements, because then
Why is that? Why?
Well, like with the buses today. You either manage to come here not too late, or you lose. You whatever, but it all continuously to live like this. How could you do that?
That's in your mind.
That you don't lose anything. That means you're not gaining anything.
Okay, fine. The struggle's going out of your life. You're at peace. Nah, that's why I think you're wrong. There's a notion. Our belief. There's a belief around it. If I don't struggle, if I don't, you know, it's like treading water. I gotta stay on top. I can't quite relax, or I'll go under. And that's the way we're kind of leading our life. And that the whole economy of gain and victory is part of that struggle to stay on top. If you give up the struggle, you become a vegetable. But you might find something completely different. You might find peace. That sounds great. The very first teaching that the Buddha gave was the truth of suffering. And sometimes we don't want to, we want to move to the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering, before we've really gotten a feel for what the first truth is trying to get across to ourselves. You're very fortunate. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. So, can I move on? Okay. I might get angry if I. the causes of anger. So, trying to, you know, there is anger is like, I'm using just kind of my own kind of simplistic notions and thoughts around this. So you won't find this in the Abhidharma and so forth. But it's the way I've come to think about these notions, and I've found it, you know, helpful. So I'm just sharing that notion with you. The misguided attempt to resolve the basic conflict of I want and I can't have. I want and I can't have. That's what anger is all about. So that there's an inner distress. It's coupled with a frustrated desire. There's inner distress coupled or associated with frustrated desire, arising from frustrated desire, and conditioned by certain irrational beliefs. And so we're trying to deconstruct anger. How is it coming about? Everything is a dependent arising. And we can look to this definition and how to go about doing that. So an angry person, they lack the coping skills necessary to remain undisturbed in the face of a problematic situation. There is always an exaggeration of the unattractiveness of the object. You know, we can overgeneralize, for example. You know, this exaggeration could take many, many, many forms, different belief systems. You're always doing this. And how many times do you hear that? You always do that. Or you jump to a conclusion, you know. Now it's completely ruined. Or you magnify it out of proportion. This is awful. Things should not be like this. I can't stand it. You're a terrible person for having done it. You know, I'm just giving you some ideas about some feeling, what I mean by irrational beliefs. But they can be much more subtle than that. They're much more complicated than that. So there is a fundamental cause. The fundamental cause is a distressed mind. We can just say unhappiness of mind. Happy people don't get angry. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. While you're happy, anger does not arise. Then there is a frustrated desire. You have a desire. The fewer desires that you have, the fewer frustrated desires that you will have. Therefore, the less angry occasions for anger that arise in your life. So there's an I want, I can't have. There's a frustrated desire. And then thirdly, the other cooperative condition is the identification of something which is stopping you from getting what you want. Something which is stopping you from fulfilling your desire. And I'm just becoming more aware of. You know, we can be, and I think it's helpful in talking about it in this way, is in looking at how the mind is being conditioned, the various chains of reaction which culminate in, for example, anger and so forth, is that anger is simply not a thing in our head. I think it's not, it doesn't have a life of its own, as it were. One of the main fundamental notions of Buddhism, it's a slogan of Buddhism, in fact. You know, print badges, dependent arising. If this is present, this arises. If this is not present, this does not arise. It sounds so simplistic that its profundity is oftentimes overlooked. And getting a sense of the complex of what we're talking about as anger and how its evolution. And it's, you know, we have a sense that anger is more like a fever. You know, if you go out into the cold weather and you don't dress properly, you get wet, you get a cold, and your body manifests a fever. It's a state of your physical being. Likewise, there is, if given certain conditions, certain causes, there is an expression of a state of mind, just at which we call anger. It is not a substantial entity, just like fever is not a thing, a substantial entity. It's a state, the state of our physical being. And anger is the state of our mental being. So, you know, it's not as if there's some autonomous entity that's out to get us, that we have to struggle against, that we have to fight against. We give it a certain certain autonomy, and as if it had an intention to bring us harm, the very fact of anger. And we become aggressive with ourselves. And this, I think, does ourselves a great disservice. how we, you know, I spoke about sometimes anger may be in fact a problem, but how we relate with anger can even be equally a problem for ourselves. How we, you know, how we see anger. You know, it's like, for some, it's almost like a demon inside our head, you know, that's lurking in the caverns of our mind, waiting to, on the opportunity to take us over and overwhelm us in some way. You know, that would be analogous to fever is lurking somewhere in our body, just waiting for an opportunity to take over our body. Given certain conditions, a fever state arises. Given certain conditions, an angry state arises. It has no autonomy, no will of its own. I think in this way, I think it becomes more workable. We can relate with it. I think this is important. As I said, we teach what we need to learn. And the reason I think I emphasize this is that for a great deal of my life, I was afraid of my own anger. Yeah? I thought it would overwhelm me. I remember as a child growing up, it was dangerous to become angry. You put yourself in certain positions when you say, "Oh, what have I done? I'm in a fight and I don't want to be in this. But anger got me here." So there's a fear, you know, you don't even want to know about anger. And we have a sense that if I allow it to continue and so forth, it has a will of its own and it's going to take me over and I'll lose control. And therefore, this I think hinders us in actually getting to know what anger is all about, how it's arising, how it's affecting us, and the ways of working with it. I don't know, does that make a little bit of sense? Yeah. We're going to take a break pretty soon. I know you've been very patient. You haven't become angry with me yet. Who said that? You know, I think we have to understand that this basic cause, anger, is a distressed mind. It's an unhappy mind. You know, I think, you know, if I were to really become simplistic about it, is underneath it all, it's saying, "Don't hurt me." And I mean, that's really, I find that that resonates with me at some deep level. Even when somebody is expressing rage, at some of their level, they're saying, "Please don't hurt me. I'm hurt. I'm in pain. And this is the only way I can protect myself. The only way I know how. This is what the strategy that I've learned in some way or another." You know, I think in some way or another, we're always walking around to people. You know, you meet somebody at a party. "Hi, my name's Jampa. Please don't hurt me." You know? We don't say that. You know, you walk in a restaurant, you say, "I like a sandwich and a Coke, please don't hurt me." Anyway, somehow we're, maybe I'm overstating this, I mean, being a bit dramatic, I think. Okay, so, basically to sum up in terms of causes, the fundamental cause is a distressed mind. An unhappy mind, distressed mind. And there's two cooperative conditions, and these are, one is a frustrated desire, we want, we can't have, and then we identify, this is what is preventing me from getting what I want, fulfilling my wish, fulfilling my desire, and so forth. Those coming together, anger will arise. And then I want to talk about how to work with these. Having broken it down into its causes, its main cause and conditions, how can we, you know, how can we work with those causes and conditions? If this is present, then this is going to arise. If this is not present, this will not arise. How can we work with this? If we don't want that, and maybe, you know, if anger is not in fact beneficial and appropriate, maybe you'd rather not, or simply diminish its force in our life, its influence in our life. So, shall we take a break? Yeah, even. And then we'll come back and continue looking at that. Okay. You have a nice cup of tea. It's nice, wasn't it? So you know the word such as anger, it's a way that we interpret a complex of feelings and sensations and thoughts and images. And it gives rise, which a particular event gives rise to, and then we have a sense of how we're going to respond, an action that we envision as a response. So it's this whole complex we're calling anger, and so it has two aspects to it. I think we can say any emotion has two aspects to it. One is that there's an event in the world which leads us to have certain perceptions, certain sensations, certain feelings, and so forth. And, you know, for example, I see a child being hit, you know, and I perceive that as the child being harmed. I feel sensations, you know, in my body. My palpitations in the heart, and my chest tightens up, and maybe my jaw clenches, and then there's and in response to these, this whole set of feelings and sensations, emotions, and so forth, I have a sense about how I'm going to respond to that. I might, and here's where we can begin to open up. I might respond with anger. I might, you know, you big oaf, you know, somebody should hit you. Yeah. Or I could respond with compassion, wanting the harm to end, but having compassion for both the victim but also the perpetrator, you know, that they're probably hurting themselves and that they've been harmed in the past and they're expressing that their own pain upon someone else. So there's no automatic, there's an interpretation going on in terms of the event, to what these various sensations and perceptions and feelings. I introduce a belief system, and it's filtered through my interpretation, and therefore I respond in different ways. So there's not an automatic reflex. It's not as if given this, then this must arise. There are certain intervening states. The manner in which we evaluate and interpret very much determines our response. So what I'm getting at here is many of our beliefs around what's going on that we associate with the event, which probably to a large extent we might not even be aware of, that we're interpreting in light of those beliefs that we have. So it's necessary for us to begin to challenge a lot of our dysfunctional beliefs, become aware of them, and begin to dispute them in some way. And how awful for you to treat that child like that. You know, I can't stand you treating that child like that. You should not, must not behave like that. You acted in that manner toward that child. You are a terrible person, and you deserve nothing good in life. You should be punished for what you're doing. So, you know, these are rather simplistic and straightforward beliefs. A lot of our beliefs are quite unknown to ourselves and perhaps much more complicated in that way. But if we can become... If we can, this is where I think how we relate to our emotions becomes quite important in working with them. If we can begin to embrace or stay with the various difficult feelings and the pain associated with the emotion and so forth, and perhaps we can begin to deconstruct it and begin to see what lies underneath it. What is going underneath the surface of anger? You know, the terms of pain and fear and our various beliefs surrounding the event, which are coming into play. So it's not a straightforward, you know, given cause A brings about result B. In Shantideva, you know, I think Shantideva is an 8th century Indian Buddhist master, and I think his text, The Guide to the Bodhisattvas, The Way of Life, is one of the most profound and texts in all of what we might call Mahayana Buddhism, at least as it's come to Tibet. He's held in highest regard, and his painting is on the in the back of you, on the to my right. That painting is going to be His Holiness the Dalai Lama is going to be teaching the text, Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, in Melbourne, and that tonka, which is a scroll painting, will be on display there behind him. And so, how do we begin to work with these intervening belief systems, these conditions, these causes which are giving rise to this, what we're calling anger, this particular way of viewing and the way in which we envision responding. So Shantideva, so I'm just going to offer a few possibilities, and then I'd like to talk about some ways to begin to, we could consider to diminish and work with our anger. And Shantideva says, completely ignoring the stick, instead I get angry at the person who yields it. But since he in turn is provoked by hatred, I should really be angry with his hatred. So, you know, somebody hits us with a stick, okay? We get angry at the person. But what is, Shantideva is trying to bring across the point, what is the immediate cause of our harm? Isn't it the stick? I mean, that's what actually has brought our immediate pain to ourselves. But somebody would quite naturally and logically say, well, it's not the stick. The stick is being controlled by something other than itself. It had no intention to harm me. It's being controlled by the person's hand. It's not in control of itself. So Shantideva says, just as, you know, if you use that reasoning not to get angry at the stick, then why become angry at the person, since the person is also under the control of some force other than himself, his own anger? You know, if we're going to get angry at anything, why not be angry at the hatred or the anger within his own mind? So if we are to be angry at anything, it's most appropriate to be angry at the anger in the other person's mind in themselves. So we're a lot of ways of working with anger, we're trying to reframe. We can reframe either by shifting what we pay attention to, or by giving it a different meaning. You know, as was mentioned before, in talking about victory and so forth, we only have limited control. I don't know if you've ever noticed that over the world. Shit happens, okay? But all we can legitimately begin to work with is how we interpret it and how we respond to it. And that we have some greater or lesser degree of control of. And so, if we can begin to, how do we, for example, cause the mind not to be distressed? Remember, the basic cause of anger is a distressed mind. How can we, for example, reframe the situation where the mind is no longer unhappy? You know, this is one of, you know, we talked about mind training. This is one of the basic notions of mind training, is to see the value of adversity. In that, Lama Zopa, who many of you are acquainted with, who's a great master at mind training, he goes out of his ways to find problems, I think. So. You know, he would say, problems are necessary for growth. We should be glad. But I mean, this is a trained mind, you know, obviously. You know, if like the Dalai Lama, he once said, we owe the Chinese a great debt. By forcing us from our country, they made us really practice the Dharma. You know, we were becoming a little bit apathetic and complacent with the Dharma. But having to go through all the hardship and the difficulties we've confronted as refugees, we've really had to put the Dharma into practice. We owe the Chinese a great debt. Or the Chinese communists, we'll say. Yeah? So that's a trained mind. And he's not distressed. He's seen as the adversity as a means of growth. There, some of you might be aware, know of an American Zen master by the name of Charlotte Jojo Beck. I'd like to, just to read a paragraph from her. She's in which she says, "Life always gives us exactly the teacher we need at every moment. This includes every mosquito, every misfortune, every red light, every traffic jam, every obnoxious supervisor or employee, every illness, every loss, every moment of joy or depression, every addiction, every piece of garbage, every breath." So these seeming enemies, you know, like the buzzing, you know, how many times do you get uptight with a mosquito when you, you know, it's annoying, it's irritable, isn't it? All of these, you know, these obnoxious people, you know. I remember I once said to Lama Zopa, you know, I'm having some difficulties with such and such a person. And he said, well, what are you going to do with when you're a sentient being? You know, that you have to expect that to arise. You know, people are a hassle in a lesser or greater degree. You know, if we can begin to transform by power of reason all of these into our teachers. And they're no longer identified as an obstacle to our happiness. So remember, one of the cooperative conditions for the rising of anger is to see, to identify an object which is preventing us from fulfilling our desire. So I'll read another, this is by way of example. And this is an example Barbara Fredrickson gives in her book called Positivity. "I had a great lesson in this when I attended a 7-day retreat for scientists. More than once our teachers urged attendees to minimize disruption by arriving at the meditation hall on time and staying until the formal group practice was over. Even so, the guy next to me arrived 10 or 15 minutes late in every session and left whenever he felt like it, disrupting my delicious silence. Midweek, one of the teachers addressed the exact form of irritation directly. He urged us to first to mindfully acknowledge the anger we felt. This is anger. It comes with an urge to rant about how you should be treated differently. It makes you want to lash out. Then he suggested we silently thank the latecomer for giving us the opportunity to practice non-judgment and non-reactivity in the context of anger. Our gratitude, he suggested, would build our compassion and restore our serenity. I was amazed at how effective this simple reframe could be. It diffused irritation every time. Afterward, when my neighbor rustled in late, disrupting my meditation, I'd acknowledge what had just happened and silently express my gratitude. This reframe never failed to bring a smile to my face, however slight, which enabled me to return to where I was." So, in dependence upon those who prevent us from what it is that we want to get, we develop patience. And we can't, if everything goes our way, there's no opportunity to develop patience. I'm sharing some of the traditional notions. I think there is some truth to this, what's being said here. I also have to admit, it's I have to stretch my mind a little bit to kind of go along with it. I'd rather get what I want all the time, to be honest. You know, but nonetheless, It's only when people give us a hard time that we develop the coping mechanisms of mind, the skill of mind, for our minds to remain undisturbed in the face of problematic situations. That's what patience is. Patience is not just holding our temper, you know, what I call a dam-like patience, where the water is just held back. You know, if we grit our teeth, I can tell. It's a skill of mind, where you're able to see the situation in such a way that though the problem was previously a problem, it's a problematic situation, your mind is no longer disturbed by it. There's some shift in the way that the mind is seeing the situation. The tension has gone out of the discrepancy between I want and I can't have. I want peace, and this guy's coming in late, whatever the situation might be. Some way that we've been able to, that skill of mind we're calling patience. And it's these opportunities, adversities, help us to work with that. You know, it's people who give us a hard time, who show us where we're really at. So I'm beginning to, what I'm trying to emphasize here is how to work with this one area of the cooperative condition of identifying someone who is stopping you from fulfilling your desire. Okay? It's difficult people who push our buttons, who strip us of our comfortable cocoons of hypocrisy, of pretense. And they get us unstuck out of this, the stagnation of superficiality. How are you? Oh, I'm okay. It's very nice. How's your, the kind of stuff that passes for communication at a party, that kind of way of relating with others. You know, the enemy forces us to confront our issues, to question what it is we're doing and why. You know, we have to acknowledge feelings and motivations we might otherwise be unaware of, or we might find inconvenient to get in touch with, or we would normally choose to avoid. The enemy helps us to learn about ourselves. You know, this is a mind training technique about how to value your enemy. I think it was in Khalil Gibran, the Lebanese Christian mystic. He said, I've learned silence from the talkative, tolerance from the intolerant, and kindness from the unkind. Yet strange, I am ungrateful to these teachers. Anything, the enemy represents a real opportunity to practice, to go beyond our habitual patterns of based upon hope and fear. To take what we're learning and to put it into practice, to actually integrate it. You know, the enemy challenges us and helps us to change and to grow. Ultimately, those who harm us, this would be the ultimate outcome of mind training, can be seen as none other than the Buddhas. In a way, they're serving the same practical purpose. They each are helping us to grow, but in different ways. You know, Christ didn't say, for example, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, and pray for those who maltreat you, because he was either a romantic or he was confused. He saw it as a way of becoming perfect, as your Father in heaven is perfect. As, in other words, more simplistically, as a way to grow, to develop. And to grow is concomitant with a richer and more meaningful way of life. We have some kind of confidence in that. It would be a great mistake to think that pursuing this course of inner growth, pursuing a course of a spiritual path, involved learning how to skillfully avoid difficult people and painful situations. those strategies haven't worked for us. And then we can begin to challenge some of our irrational beliefs, which are the root source of the distress. If there is a way that we can fulfill our desires, then there is no use in being upset. If there isn't a way, then we have to learn acceptance. There's no other sane way to lead our life, intelligent way to lead our life. You know, this is reminiscent of, some of you are familiar with the Serenity Prayer, which is very common or popular in the 12-step program. And they call it the Serenity Prayer. You could call it the Unstressed Prayer, I think. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. You know, being upset with what cannot be changed is futile. And if we can change it, you know, then why be upset? It's more productive to direct our thoughts and our energies to bring about the kinds of desired change that we want. You know, in working, I think the first step in, and we're going to do this, you know, we're going to talk about specific antidotes, but the first step in working with anger, I think with any of the afflictive emotions, I think, in fact, with any change, I think we have to recognize that if you want to adopt some new way of thinking or some new behavior, we have to be aware of the possible resistance to any kinds of changes that we're contemplating on making. Our minds simply aren't blank slates; they are conditioned, and we sometimes only become aware of some of the conditioning factors in our mind when we only come up against resistance when we want to move forward. The resistance is not apparent until we want to do things differently. And then, you know, it's not as if there's somebody out to get us. You know, we don't want to project any sort of autonomy it is simply a great deal of the momentum of the past and its inertia seeking, which will extend into the future. There is those forces which we have to work against, we have to work with. So my point is that we have to see how the quality of the change in terms of what's this change going to cost me? What's the payoff? You know, we cannot simply make it. It has to be more than simply curiosity or speculation, wishful thinking. We have to see that it's in our own self-best interest in some way or another. We have to see, for example, that in the case of anger, is not only inappropriate and ineffective method for dealing with difficult people and situation, but it's ultimately self-defeating, destructive. And this, you know, if you begin, you have to allow the mind, you have to avail yourself of the resources of your own mind to bring about self-healing. If, you know, we have this native intelligence, if we begin to utilize it and exercise it, if we actually bring the situation to some kind of clarity for our mind, we don't have to force ourselves to be happy. It's just that we misconceive of what happiness is. That's part of our re-education process that we're involved in. If you think that putting your, you know, if you somehow have gotten the idea in some perverted fashion in one form or another that putting your hand in a flame will bring you happiness, you shouldn't be surprised that you're continually being burnt again and again and again. You know, where does our happiness lie, and where is the causes of suffering? We have to see that anger is self-defeating and destructive, and even in those situations, for example, where it might appear to be superficially beneficial in some way or another, it's important that we view our thinking and behavior in terms of the overall quality of life. I think that's an important point. That we're quite often lost in the trees, and we simply make decisions using that criteria of what is going to bring about immediate gratification. And this doesn't serve us very well in the long-term view of our life, where we want to go. So the point I'm working toward is that first, in working for anger, but I think in any bringing about any kind of change, we have to begin to address ourselves. What are, is the advantages and disadvantages of making this change? Then this serves as a platform where we can begin to work with various methods, or what we call antidotes, to diminish and begin to bring about those change. But we have to, you know, we can't trick our mind. We can't force our mind. Willpower is not enough. We have to create the inner ecology of a mind which is receptive to the kinds of changes that we're seeking to bring about. We have to work with the resistance. If, you know, it's not enough that your teacher said it would be better if you were compassionate. And you think, oh, that would be nice. That would be nice. People would like me if I was compassionate. I wouldn't have all these hassles anymore. There's some kind of payoff around anger. It's my point. It's served you in some way in the past. And maybe it's gone unquestioned. Is it still of use to yourself in the present? And maybe it isn't serving you all that well. But you have to begin to analyze it and investigate it. You have to look at what are the advantages if I stay with this? If I don't change? What are the disadvantages if I don't change? You know, we can't know all the details of change. There has to be some confidence, some trust that on the other side of change, I'm going to be a better person leading a better life in a better world, to some degree or other, in some way or another, some fashion or other. What we can know is, though I might not know in all the details of that change that I want to make, I'm not quite sure how it's going to play out, how it's going to manifest. But what I can know is, what will happen if I don't change? So we have to look at both ways. What will happen if I don't change, and what will happen if I do change? And then the mind will naturally correct itself. You know, we don't have to force the mind. I don't think we can, realistically. The mind will naturally begin to evolve in the direction which it sees as its happiness lies, where its treasure lies. I think that's kind of an intelligent approach, I think. So what I was going to do is, would you flip that board over? The advantages of anger. Oh, this has probably never been taught before. I just listed two. Okay? I have a list here. These are what I've thought about, where I think anger can be useful. So what I'd like for you to do. We stop at 5 o'clock, don't we? That's a shame. I never get anywhere. No, I think it wouldn't be. My plan, aside from meditation, which we probably won't be doing, was to break up into small groups and really go through and come up with a list of the advantages of anger. And I was just kind of getting you started by listing two of them that I see. You know, it's a way that we, you know, that we express things that we truly feel, but we for one reason or another, we normally find it too difficult to say. It's almost like you want to say this, so you have to find some pretext to get angry so that it comes out. Wow, I'm glad I got that out finally. You know, that's an advantage of anger. So, well, I'm not saying. I think so. We have a belief that is an advantage of anger. I mean, we have to acknowledge that. I believe at some level of my cognitive awareness that that's an advantage, that's a belief of mine. That's going to resist bringing about diminishing the force of anger in my life. That belief is going to take me in the opposite direction. It's a conflicted process. I want to move in this direction, and this belief is taking me in an opposite direction. So I have to at least become aware of it, and then I have to begin to dispute it. Is it, in fact, an advantage? I've probably never investigated it before. I've just kind of gone along with it, accepted. I picked it up somewhere along the way. So this is what I was going to do. I don't know if... would somebody like to scribe? Anybody? Will you do that for us, please? So I've just written two. Okay, anger assists us in getting what we want. You know, if somebody's get out of my way, I'm gonna, you know, yeah, I'm sorry, I'll get out of your way. Angry people oftentimes get what they want. That seems superficially, at least, to be a real advantage. Okay, any other advantages? Whatever you know, you have to please. Oh, okay. It says, it is advantages of anger. It is a way we are able to express what it is we truly feel, but which we normally find too difficult to say. Number one. Number two, it assists us in getting what it is we want, in getting our way. Anger helps us to get what we want. It helps us to get our way. Please.
It might be the same, but it's also a way of controlling.
So, anger is an effective way to maintain control. Okay. Please. So first we're going to look at the advantage. We're not going to question them. Then we're going to go back.
No, I don't want to question it, but it's just that it seems like it's not really a way to express, but it's something that helps us to express. It's like a tool for
okay.
Express it by being assertive or by doing whatever, but I think it's more what makes us,
Anger it helps us to express. So above the word way, helps us.
So it helps us to express.
It helps us to express. Okay, good point. Please. So we're just looking at advantages. It enables us to show how terrible other people are. Okay. So. Okay. So the effective way to maintain control. Okay. Make up. It boosts our confidence. Could you tease that out? Okay. It empowers us. How's that? Empowers us. Yeah, good. Energizing and empowering and energizing. Yeah, feel strength. Please. Maintain the rage. So it aids in it's effective in bringing about social change. Okay. Okay. So that would be controlling, maintaining control, bring about social change. It's an effective means of bringing about social change. Please.
Sometimes you can get safe in a dangerous situation.
Okay, it's a way of protecting yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah. it's a good one. It's a good one. Self-protection. we haven't evaluated them yet. We don't want to jump the gun here. Please. Okay. So maybe we can combine that with effective way to maintain control over over events and people. Manipulate. Please. Feeds our ego. So, where it says, it protects us, yeah, protect, safe, protects. It said, empower. So your point was, I didn't want to forget your point. Justifies our position. Yeah. Okay. Any others? Just advantages that you feel, you know. Okay. Protect. Let's see, where did it say? It helps us to stay safe, protect ourselves and others. Yeah. And others, second from the bottom. And others, yeah. What's mine, my children, my so forth. My yeah. Please? Okay. Justifies our position? Okay. Please, back.
But maybe just reaffirms that they're horrible.
Is that good enough? Please, in the back. So, yeah. We're just going to look at it from one point of view for right now, but you're right. But we're not going to dispute it for the moment. We're going to bring that in. So it helps us to be heard, the very first one. It helps us to express, to express and also to be heard. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Draws attention to us. People. You pay attention to what I, yeah. You aren't listening. Yeah. Maybe I'm mistaken. I don't know. Maybe I got this all wrong. Okay, any other? Okay, so how could we? Okay, so it helps us to. It provokes us out of apathy. Okay, provoke. How about energizes and empowers us as individuals and groups? Yeah. Okay, it empowers us and energizes ourselves as individuals and groups. Individuals and groups. And it assists us, yeah. In the second one was it assists us in getting what we want, in getting our way. It activates. You know, it brings change, it brings action, activates. Okay, I think you got the idea here. So, you know, this is what I think is really necessary. It's almost like it's useful to keep a notebook and in your daily life, and to be mindful. And as you go through life, and you go through your daily life, and you notice a little bit of irritation, and it doesn't have to be a full scale punch out, but you know what's the belief operating here? What kind of advantage do I expect out of that? These are running at some level. You know, there's a reason these patterns maintain themselves, that they're held in place, and these kind of beliefs hold these patterns, such as anger and so forth, these habitual ways of responding in place. And we have to acknowledge those and work with those if we're going to actually bring about change. We have to begin to dismantle or disrupt or intervene with this kind of resistance. Now, what we could do here is, you could do this for yourself, but we're doing it as a group. I think it's really useful. Is begin to dispute. Does it actually work? Is it in terms of our overall perspective, our long view of life, in terms of our greater aspirations, our value, our central core values? You know, it may get you, it may get in what you might immediately want, but how does that fit in with your higher aspirations, your core values, your long-term perspective, and what the direction you want to go in your life? How does that fit in with that? Okay, so you know, we have to begin to look at it in those kinds of terms, I think, and to begin to reframe it in another way. What about this first one? It helps us to exercise what it helps us to express what we truly feel. Is anger necessary to do that? No. I mean, it's true, it does help, but couldn't we learn a skill whereby we could express what we truly feel without the need to generate anger? Okay. So it's not a necessary condition for getting what that advantage. We could have that advantage of being able to express what we want without having recourse to anger. We could do it in a much more, and probably a much more skillful way. Remember I said all the negative emotions are wrong consciousnesses. They're not addressing the precise nature of the object. There's always a disparity. So we're not as skillful. I don't know about for you, but I get terribly confused when I become angry. You know, I don't think very clearly. I know that. It doesn't work very well for me. So I probably would rather say what I truly feel and have the composure of mind. Even I would be great if I could do it with a sense of presence and a sense of even of compassion, both for myself and the other person, in that kind of context. I think I would be heard. I think the communication would be all the better. I think I would be that much more effective in what I really, having that other person hear what I really wanted to say. They wouldn't shut down. I wouldn't set up a barrier. I think it would be much more skillful. Yeah. So you're operating with a belief that people should listen to you. Why should they listen to you? What right do you have to demand of other people that they listen to you? There's no logical reason that the world should listen to what you have to say. It'd be nice.
I think that's
communication then starts to break down. So yeah.
That's right, yeah. You might feel dejected, you might feel hurt, you might be sad. But we're talking about whether it leads to anger. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right, I agree. We're talking about the consequence of anger at the moment, and if it's working. Anyway, I think let's do a couple more, and then I think you have the idea. It is this and get what do we want. How would you dispute that, or can you dispute that? How do you qualify that? It doesn't always get you. Could you give an example? They're going to go. So anger isn't necessarily an effective method for getting what you want. It doesn't work sometimes.
You might get what you want in that situation, but you might leave another person with a residue of anger and a score set.
Yeah, so it's not...
That could be described as the geopolitics.
Okay.
You know, in general.
So it's... Yeah. Yeah, please.
An ex employee was angry with the decision of his boss, and he went and went back to the CEO and asked for it to be changed. And the CEO went to his boss and said, "Sort it out with him." And he got fired.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's right. That's right. No, that's right. I. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I think you're getting the idea of working. You know, there's no sense in talking about anger and getting rid of anger unless we begin to understand, you know, what the resistance is involved in it. And I think so. We have to look at for ourselves. It has to be something very personal to ourselves. You know, maybe some of those you identify with, they resonate, and it's not as if. You know, we're not trying to be good boys and girls, you know, trying to please. You know, we're doing this for in our own self best interests to become, to lead a more successful life. So it has to be something that we do for ourselves. It's a way of caring for ourselves, treating ourselves well.
Because I'm a bit of a passive person, and when I do something that really makes me feel I'm angry, I feel empowered because
it empowers us, energizes.
So not feeling angry yourself, causing others to feel angry.
Yeah.
You feel like you affect other
people. You're manipulating other people. Yeah. So the. That's true. <to him. laughs> Okay, so we looked at So looking at the advantages of anger, and in order to, and we have our agenda here, don't we, that we're going to see if in fact these are true advantages in the overall long-term perspective of our life in terms of our core values, what it is that we want for ourselves, the direction we want to go in our life. From that perspective, are these real advantages? And, you know, it's something that you have to do for yourself. You can't pretend or you can't fake it. You have to exercise your own intelligence, utilize that emotional intelligence. Then we look at the disadvantages of anger, and I think this is quite useful. You know, for example, again quoting from Shantideva in his Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, he says, "Who intentionally forged the weapons of hell? Who constructed the burning iron floors? The Buddha taught that all such things arise from destructive elements within one's own mind." So, you know, we can talk about hell as an actual place, or we can talk about it in terms of as a psychological state, if you like. And it's pervaded by aggression, by hostility, by paranoia. You know, these are simply destructive elements within our own mind. You know, this is one reason I begin to question a type of therapy which sees emotions as neutral. That would tend to, anger kind of is almost is kind of it can feed on itself. You know, it's like a crocodile that's eating its own tail. And the more it eats, the more it's nourished. The more it's nourished, the more its tail grows, and the more that it has to eat. So the more that we become angry, the more that we become angry. It facilitates itself, and the pathways within the brain and become more and more entrenched and laid down. So I think I'm not saying that we are to suppress or try to deny our anger. But I would say that we have to take. It's useful to begin to take a position with regard to that state of mind, to see it. It's not in our own self-interest in some way or another. That it does have disadvantages. So, what is the cost of anger in our lives? You know, we can't trust people. We can't even trust ourselves. You know, we find ourselves alone, unloved, unable to love. You know, most basically, we live in fear. I think underneath it all, that's where, you know, I always like to think of Michael Lunig, where he has a verse, and it's a very short verse, but in it he says there are only two basic emotions, love and fear. And, you know, I think the more that we hate, the more that we take recourse to anger and hostility, the more readily it arises in our mind and our world, and we project this onto others. In our world, we are beginning to see ourselves as surrounded, and we live in a world with a vision of paranoia. You know, encircled by an inhospitable world. Why is it that, you know, that we feel so the great need to protect ourselves, that we have all these defensive shields between ourselves, that we feel like, why do we feel like aliens in an alien world? That we can't really trust each other, that we can't communicate with each other in the ways that we do. You know, it also weakens, I think that all comes from this quality of anger. You know, we can hurt. You know, there's this song. You only hurt the one you love, the one you don't really want to hurt at all. You know, we hurt when we're angry. We can hurt those who care for us the most. Sometimes even people who care for ourselves, maybe more than we ourselves care for ourselves, but we're willing to hurt them. That's terribly sad. It's a tragedy in that way, isn't it? An angry person is suffering. They're afraid. They're in pain. they don't want to be hurt anymore. But it's the only way they know to protect themselves. And it doesn't work. And, you know, if understanding that for ourselves within our own experience in some way or another. It also, you know, anger, and this is, you know, one of the more traditional presentations of the disadvantages of anger, it weakens and destroys our predispositions to these tendencies of the mind to see things in a positive fashion. You know, this would be traditionally would say, anger destroys positive karma. What does that mean? You know, if we kind of tease it out a little bit. You know, our ability, you know, the world isn't out there objectively, and we ourselves are simply passive observers, like a mirror, and it just overwhelms us with what it is. The world is co-created. We are continually involved in world making. The type of world that we find ourselves in is very much, is in part dependent upon our own minds, our own attitudes, the tendencies of our own mind, the predispositions of our own mind, karmic seeds within our own mind. We you know, it's like if you have a puppy that's been abused, and you know, you go to the dog, to the do you call it a dog pound? You go, I'm still learning Aussie. You go to the dog pound and you get this puppy, but it's come from an abused home. It's been, and you have the warmest of intentions toward this puppy, the kindest of regards for it, and you go to pet it, and it sees this hand coming toward it, and it squeals and yelps and runs in the corner. Nothing from the side of the hand had the intention to bring harm. But that puppy's mind is conditioned, isn't it? It's been traumatized in some way. It's interpreting that as your hand as a threat, isn't it? And it causes its pain, its suffering, isn't it? But there's nothing from the side of the hand at all, from your side, which intends harm. So the qualities of our mind, the ways our minds are being conditioned, causes us to interpret things as in a positive light, or in a negative light. I was going to refer to that, but kind of, you know, like this glass of water. You know, if this glass were half with water, I won't say filled. Some people would say the glass was half empty. Some people would say it was half full. You know. What it is that you pay attention to, and how you interpret what you pay attention to, how you perceive it. You know, what are the conditioning factors in your mind which are directing you in that fashion? You know, a glass of water makes no big deal, but some people see the world as benevolent, as hospitable, as a kind and generous world. Other people see that same world as hostile, as full of suffering, and not to be trusted. It's the same world. Why does one person see it in one way and another person sees it in another? It's due to the conditioning factors within our own mind. Anger will destroy those factors in the mind which predispose you to see situations in a more positive light. What we'd say happiness, in other words, in a favorable way. So that's a far-reaching consequence of anger. It not only has immediate effects, both in terms of you and the other. Anger immediately disturbs your own mind. It causes harm to others, but it's going to have long-term effects in the way that you experience the world in your life. So there's a long list of possible ways, you know. I'm just naming some disadvantages of anger, okay? And then we can talk about, which we're not going to have time, you know, working with anger. So once we have this platform, we have the motivation to begin to work. We're receptive. We're actually open to the possibility. It's just not, it's something more than curiosity or speculation, or wouldn't it be nice to be less anger? We begin to see that it's in our own self-best interest. At some deep level of our being, I want to change this. This isn't working for me. How am I going to do this? Here's some methods. Yeah. So then you're really open. There's a possibility that these methods can be effective. Otherwise, it's simply going to be met. It's going to be like pouring oil on water. It just kind of floats on our minds. It's not going to be integrated. It's not going to become who we are. So there is, you know, some various methods of working with anger that we can maybe we can go into next time. Okay. Okay. And we have about 5 minutes. Any comments? Anything you'd like to share before we break up? Yes, please. Sadness in action. That's a good way to think about it, I think. It's very helpful.
So if we were to want to eliminate sadness, is it a natural process that we have to go through the anger?
Oh, I see. If you want to eliminate sadness.
Yeah?
Could you run that by me again, please?
Sadness comes from some feeling of helplessness, powerlessness.
Okay.
And then when you want to eliminate, you want to be empowered. You want to come from power. It comes out as anger.
Okay.
So you say, "Oh, this is not good."
Yeah.
You fall back into
sadness. So do you think you could find ways of feeling your own inner strength that you could feel confident and strong with inside yourself without making use of anger? Do you think that's possible? Could we find ways to do that? it's funny. It's really an important point you're bringing up. You know, if it's part of, it's almost the basis of the path, believing that I can do something. You know, that I think, you know, we can, there are various ways, like, you know, looking at our Buddha nature. For example, I have that potential. I think it's very important that we have that sense of inner strength and confidence that we can do something, empower ourselves. I don't think anger, it's not a very skillful way of doing that. It's sadness,
yeah.
Or you use the word powerlessness.
Yes.
The yeah.
Sadness comes from some sort of powerlessness or unknowingness or ignorance, you know, not knowing the situation.
Yeah, I think there's a complex of feelings in the associations there, and we'd have to tease that out. But I think your question is quite a good one. We had a question.
Looks at how then, when we know we're angry, how can we attend to it
When it's skillful, it's good for both parties. When it's not skillful, we hurt ourselves and we can hurt the other as well. I really love the point when earlier you said, when A is angry at B, it's not just one person suffering, it's not just B, two persons are suffering. I think that is one of the contributions of Buddhism.
Thank you for that. There was a point over here, and then really important. That's a good point. The ways to finding ways to self-comfort and be kind to yourself, because we are, I mean, we're wounded people. We all have our wounds in various ways, and we have to find ways to care for ourselves. Yes, please. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it reminds me of the violent peace demonstrations back in the 70s.
I was just going to reflect on the concept of blame and how it leads to anger. And what I found in my own life is that if I can deal with the blame separately to start with, then a lot of the anger dissipates. And it's actually the process of blame So one of the ways of reducing the impact of anger is to start to deal with your feelings about blame and that sort of stuff. And if you can deal with that, then the anger dissipates without having to.
So you found some tools to work with, tools for yourself, yeah. You think that's... That's a very... Yeah, it's a good point.
you have no power and you don't see any way out, you're powerless totally, then you get very angry.
In the moment of anger.
And then what we do, we put the blame on somebody else instead of walking away. In my experience, I find better to walk away from the powerlessness and deal with that later with myself, but not to get involved with the person as if that is angry. I find that very, very helpful for me. But I think powerless people are very angry, and in my experience, I know that. Yeah. I've been in the war in my country, and I lost my house and everything in the house, and I didn't have a home and everything, and I lived there for 15 years, and I was so upset and angry because I can't go home, yeah, and I have nothing, yeah, and I come back to Australia, and as I find meditation and Buddhism, I become very calm. I don't think about past, and I'm not angry anymore. And that's how I deal with my problems, you see, with my anger. But I was angry. I was crying every day when I was there. I didn't have anything. It was all about material things. But as when I realized that, it was that I calmed down.
Mm-hmm.
It was only material things that we get. We want the power, we want money, we want everything we think in our head or see anyway. And that's what makes us angry. But see, for me, it doesn't really matter anymore.
So you've come to. Yeah.
But it helped meditate. Since I found Buddhism and meditation, it's just something that it can't be described.
Good on you. You've come through a lot, haven't you?
Yeah.
Thank you for that. One more comment. That's one of the beliefs you have.
Sorry?
That's one of the beliefs you have.
Yeah.
So you.
For me, it makes me feel less in control. It's like, well, it's part of my animal nature.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's other things that
control. Yeah. So I'm going to have to. It's past five. We can continue this discussion next month. Okay. Thank you all.